but it is not a business for slapping. Maria, Pilar said, I will not touch thee. Tell me now of thy own volition. De tu propia voluntad, the words were in Spanish. The girl shook her head. Maria, Pilar said, now and of thy own volition. You hear me? Anything at all? No, the girl said softly. No and no. Now you will tell me, Pilar told her. Anything at all. You will see. Now you will tell me. The earth moved, Maria said, not looking at the woman. Truly. It was a thing I cannot tell thee. So, Pilar said, and her voice was warm and friendly, and there was no compulsion in it. But Robert Jordan noticed there were small drops of perspiration on her forehead and her lips. So there was that. So that was it. It is true, Maria said, and bit her lip. Of course it is true, Pilar said kindly. But do not tell it to your own people, for they never will believe you. You have no Cali blood, Inglés? She got to her feet, Robert Jordan helping her up. No, he said, not that I know of.
Nor has the Maria that she knows of, Pilar said.
Pues es muy raro.
It is very strange.
But it happened, Pilar, Maria said.
¿Cómo que no, hija? Pilar said.
Why not, daughter?
When I was young, the earth moved so that you could feel it all shift in space and were afraid it would go out from under you. It happened every night.
You lie, Maria said.
Yes, Pilar said. I lie. It never moves more than 3 times in a lifetime.
Did it really move?
Yes, the girl said. Truly.
For you, Inglés?
Pilar looked at Robert Jordan.
Don't lie.
Yes, he said, truly.
Good, said Pilar.
Good. That is something.
What do you mean about the 3 times? Maria asked. Why do you say that?
3 times, said Pilar. Now you've had one.
Only 3 times?
For most people, never, Pilar told her.
You are sure it moved?
One could have fallen off, Maria said.
I guess it moved then, Pilar said. Come then, and let us get to camp.
What's this nonsense about 3 times? Robert Jordan said to the big woman as they walked through the pines together.
Nonsense, she looked at him wryly. Don't talk to me of nonsense, little English.
Is it a wizardry, like the palms of the hands?
Nay, it is common and proven knowledge with gitanos.
But we are not gitanos.
Nay, but you have had a little luck.
Non-gypsies have a little luck sometimes.
You mean it truly about the 3 times?
She looked at him again, oddly.
Leave me, Inglés, she said. Don't molest me. You are too young for me to speak to.
But Pilar, Maria said.
Shut up, Pilar told her. You have had one, and there are 2 more in the world for thee.
And you? Robert Jordan asked her.
2, said Pilar, and put up 2 fingers.
2.
And there will never be a 3rd.
Why not? Maria asked.
Oh, shut up, Pilar said. Shut up. Busnes of thy age bore me.
Why not a 3rd? Robert Jordan asked.
Oh, shut up, will you? Pilar said. Shut up.
All right, Robert Jordan said to himself. Only I'm not having any. I've known a lot of gypsies, and they are strange enough, but so are we. The difference is we have to make an honest living. Nobody knows what tribes we came from, nor what our tribal inheritance is, nor what the mysteries were in the woods where the people lived that we came from. All we know is that we do not know. We know nothing about what happens to us in the nights. When it happens in the day, though, it is something. Whatever happened, happened. And now this woman not only has to make the girl say it when she did not want to, but she has to take it over and make it her own. She has to make it into a gypsy thing. I thought she took a beating up the hill, but she was certainly dominating just now back there. If it had been evil, she should have been shot. But it wasn't evil. It was only wanting to keep her hold on life, to keep it through Maria. When you get through with this war, you might take up the study of women, he said to himself. You could start with Pilar. She has put in a pretty complicated day, if you ask me. She never brought in the gypsy stuff before, except the hand, he thought. Yes, of course, the hand. And I don't think she was faking about the hand. She wouldn't tell me what she saw, of course. Whatever she saw, she believed in herself. But that proves nothing.
Listen, Pilar, he said to the woman.
Pilar looked at him and smiled. "What is it?" she asked.
"Don't be so mysterious," Robert Jordan said. "These mysteries tire me very much."
"So?" Pilar said.
"I do not believe in ogres, soothsayers, fortune-tellers, or chicken-crut gypsy witchcraft."
"Oh," said Pilar. "No, and you can leave the girl alone."
"I will leave the girl alone."
"And leave the mysteries," Robert Jordan said. "We have enough work and enough things that will be done without complicating it with chicken-crut. Fewer mysteries and more work."
"I see," said Pilar, and nodded her head in agreement.
"And listen, Inglés," she said, and smiled at him.
"Did the earth move?"
"Yes, goddamn you, it moved."
Pilar laughed and laughed, and stood looking at Robert Jordan, laughing.
"Oh, Inglés, Inglés," she said, laughing. "You are very comical. You must do much work now to regain thy dignity."
"The hell with you," Robert Jordan thought, but he kept his mouth shut. While they had spoken, the sun had clouded over, and as he looked back up toward the mountains, the sky was now heavy and gray.
"Sure," Pilar said to him, looking at the sky. "It will snow."
"Now? Almost in June?"
"Why not? These mountains do not know the names of the months. We are in the moon of May."
"It can't be snow," he said. "It can't snow."
"Just the same, Inglés," she said to him, "it will snow."
Robert Jordan looked up at the thick gray of the sky, with the sun gone faintly yellow, and now as he watched, gone completely, and the gray becoming uniform so that it was soft and heavy, the gray now cutting off the tops of the mountains.
"Yes," he said, "I guess you are right."
Chapter 14. By the time they reached the camp, it was snowing, and the flakes were dropping diagonally through the pines. They slanted through the trees, sparse at first, and circling as they fell, and then as the cold wind came driving down the mountain, they came whirling and thick, and Robert Jordan stood in front of the cave in a rage and watched them.
"We will have much snow," Pablo said. His voice was thick and his eyes were red and bleary.
"Has the gypsy come in?" Robert Jordan asked him.
"No," Pablo said. "Neither him nor the old man."
"Will you come with me to the upper post on the road?"
"No," Pablo said. "I will take no part in this."
"I will find it myself."
"In this storm you might miss it," Pablo said. "I would not go now."
"It's just downhill to the road and then follow it up."
"You could find it. But thy two sentries will be coming up now with the snow and you would miss them on the way."
"The old man is waiting for me."
"Nay, he will come in now with the snow."
Pablo looked at the snow that was blowing fast now past the mouth of the cave and said,
"You do not like the snow, Inglés?"
Robert Jordan swore, and Pablo looked at him through his bleary eyes and laughed.
"With this thy offensive goes, Inglés," he said. "Come into the cave and thy people will be in directly."
Inside the cave, Maria was busy at the fire and Pilar at the kitchen table. The fire was smoking, but as the girl worked with it, poking in a stick of wood and then fanning it with a folded paper, there was a puff, and then a flare, and the wood was burning, drawing brightly as the wind sucked a draft out of the hole in the roof.
"And this snow?" Robert Jordan said. "You think there will be much?"
"Much," Pablo said contentedly, then called to Pilar. "You don't like it, woman, either? Now that you command, you do not like this snow?"
"Amique," Pilar said over her shoulder. "If it snows, it snows."
"Drink some wine, Inglés," Pablo said. "I have been drinking all day waiting for the snow."
"Give me a cup," Robert Jordan said.
"To the snow," Pablo said, and touched cups with him.
Robert Jordan looked him in the eyes and clinked his cup. "You bleary-eyed, murderous sod," he thought. "I'd like to clink this cup against your teeth." "Take it easy," he told himself. "Take it easy."
"It is very beautiful, the snow," Pablo said. "You won't want to sleep outside with the snow falling."
"So that's on your mind too, is it?" Robert Jordan thought. "You've a lot of troubles, haven't you, Pablo?"
"No," he said politely.
"No, very cold," Pablo said. "Very wet."
"You don't know why those old eiderdowns cost $65, Robert Jordan thought. "I'd like to have a dollar for every time I've slept in that thing in the snow."
"Then I should sleep in here?" he asked politely.
"Yes."
"Thanks," Robert Jordan said. "I'll be sleeping outside."
"In the snow?"
"Yes,
damn your bloody red pig eyes and your swine bristly swine's end of a face. In the snow. In the utterly damned, ruinous, unexpected, slutting, defeat-conniving, bastard cessary of the snow. He went over to where Maria had just put another piece of pine on the fire. Very beautiful, the snow, he said to the girl.
But it is bad for the work, isn't it? She asked him. Aren't you worried?
Que va, he said. Worrying is no good. When will supper be ready? I thought you would have an appetite, Pilar said. Do you want a cut of cheese now? Thanks, he said, and she cut him a slice, reaching up to unhook the big cheese that hung in a net from the ceiling, drawing a knife across the open end and handing him the heavy slice. He stood eating it. It was just a little too goaty to be enjoyable. Maria, Pablo said from the table where he was sitting.
What?
The girl asked. Wipe the table clean, Maria, Pablo said, and grinned at Robert Jordan.
Wipe thine own spillings, Pilar said to him. Wipe first thy chin and thy shirt and then the table.
Maria, Pablo called.
Pay no heed to him, he is drunk, Pilar said.
Maria, Pablo called. It is still snowing and the snow is beautiful. He doesn't know about that robe, Robert Jordan thought. Good old pig eyes doesn't know why I paid the Woods boys $65 for that robe. I wish the gypsy would come in, though. As soon as the gypsy comes, I'll go after the old man. I should go now, but it is very possible that I would miss them. I don't know where he is posted. Want to make snowballs? He said to Pablo. Want to have a snowball fight?
What?
Pablo asked. What do you propose?
Nothing, Robert Jordan said.
Got your saddles covered up good?
Yes.
Then in English, Robert Jordan said, going to grain those horses or peg them out and let them dig for it?
What?
Nothing. It's your problem, old pal. I'm going out of here on my feet.
Why do you speak in English? Pablo asked.
I don't know, Robert Jordan said. When I get very tired, sometimes I speak English. Or when I get very disgusted or baffled, say. When I get highly baffled, I just talk English to hear the sound of it. It's a reassuring noise. You ought to try it sometime.
What do you say, Inglés? Pilar said. It sounds very interesting, but I do not understand.
Nothing, Robert Jordan said. I said nothing in English.
Well, then talk Spanish, Pilar said. It's shorter and simpler in Spanish.
Surely, Robert Jordan said. But, oh boy, he thought. Oh, Pablo, oh, Pilar, oh, Maria. Oh, you two brothers in the corner whose names I've forgotten and must remember, but I get tired of it sometimes. Of it and of you and of me and of the war. And why and all why did it have to snow now? That's too bloody much. No, it's not. Nothing is too bloody much. You just have to take it and fight out of it. And now stop prima donnaing and accept the fact that it is snowing as you did a moment ago. And the next thing is to check with your gypsy and pick up your old man. But to snow. Now, in this month. Cut it out, he said to himself. Cut it out and take it. It's that cup, you know. How did it go about the cup? He'd either have to improve his memory or else never think of quotations, because when you missed one, it hung in your mind like a name you had forgotten and you could not get rid of it. How did it go about the cup? Let me have a cup of wine, please, he said in Spanish. Then, lots of snow, eh? He said to Pablo. Mucha nieve. The drunken man looked up at him and grinned. He nodded his head and grinned again.
No offensive. No aviones, no bridge, just snow, Pablo said.
You expect it to last a long time? Robert Jordan sat down by him. You think we're going to be snowed in all summer, Pablo, old boy?
All summer, no, Pablo said. Tonight and tomorrow, yes.
What makes you think so?
There are two kinds of storms, Pablo said,
heavily and judiciously.
One comes from the Pyrenees. With this one there is great cold. It is too late for this one.
Good, Robert Jordan said. That's something.
This storm comes from the Cantabrico, Pablo said. It comes from the sea. With the wind in this direction, there will be a great storm and much snow.
Where did you learn all this, old-timer? Robert Jordan asked. Now that his rage was gone, he was excited by this storm, as he was always by all storms. In a blizzard, a gale, a sudden line squall, a tropical storm, or a summer thunder shower in the mountains, there was an excitement that came to him from no other thing. It was like the excitement of battle, except that it was clean. There is a wind that blows through battle, but that was a hot wind, hot and dry as your mouth, and it blew heavily, hot and dirtily. and it rose and died away with the fortunes of the day. He knew that wind well. But a snowstorm was the opposite of all of that. In the snowstorm you came close to wild animals, and they were not afraid. They traveled across country, not knowing where they were, and the deer stood sometimes in the lee of the cabin. In a snowstorm you rode up to a moose, and he mistook your horse for another moose, and trotted forward to meet you. In a snowstorm it always seemed for a time as though there were no enemies. In a snowstorm the wind could blow a gale, but it blew a white cleanness, and the air was full of a driving whiteness, and all things were changed, and when the wind stopped, there would be the stillness. This was a big storm, and he might as well enjoy it. It was ruining everything, but you might as well enjoy it.
I was an arroyero for many years, Pablo said. We trucked freight across the mountains with the big carts before the camions came into use. In that business, we learned the weather.
And how did you get into the movement?
I was always of the left, Pablo said. We had many contacts with the people of Asturias, where they are much developed politically. I have always been for the Republic.
But what were you doing before the movement?
I worked then for a horse contractor at Zaragoza. He furnished horses for the bullrings, as well as remounts for the army. It was then that I met Pilar, who was, as she told you, with the matador Finito de Palencia.
He said this with considerable pride. He wasn't much of a matador, one of the brothers at the table said, looking at Pilar's back where she stood in front of the stove. No, Pilar said, turning around and looking at the man. He wasn't much of a matador. Standing there now in the cave by the cooking fire, she could see him, short and brown and sober-faced, with the sad eyes, the cheeks sunken and the black hair curled wet on his forehead where the tight-fitting matador's hat had made a red line that no one else noticed. She saw him stand now, facing the 5-year-old bull, facing the horns that had lifted the horses high, the great neck thrusting the horse up, up as that rider poked into that neck with the spiked pole, thrusting up and up until the horse went over with a crash and the rider fell against the wooden fence, and with the bull's legs thrusting him forward, the big neck swung the horns that searched the horse for the life that was in him. She saw him, Finito, the not-so-good matador, now standing in front of the bull and turning sideways toward him. She saw him now clearly as he furled the heavy flannel cloth around the stick, the flannel hanging blood-heavy from the passes where it had swept over the bull's head and shoulders, and the wet streaming shine of his withers and on down and over his back as the bull raised into the air and the banderillas clattered. She saw Finito standing 5 paces from the bull's head, profiled, the bull standing still and heavy, and draw the sword slowly up until it was level with his shoulder, and then sight along the dipping blade at a point he could not yet see because the bull's head was higher than his eyes. He would bring that head down with the sweep his left arm would make with the wet, heavy cloth, but now he rocked back a little on his heels and sighted along the blade, profiled in front of the splintered horn, the bull's chest heaving and his eyes watching the cloth. She saw him very clearly now, and she heard his thin, clear voice as he turned his head and looked toward the people in the first row of the ring above the red fence and said, "Let's see if we can kill him like this." She could hear the voice, and then see the first bend of the knee as he started forward and watched his voyage in onto the horn that lowered now magically as the bull's muzzle followed the low swept cloth, the thin brown wrist controlled, sweeping the horns down and past as the sword entered the dusty height of the withers. She saw its brightness going in slowly and steadily, as though the bull's rush plucked it into himself and out from the man's hand, and she watched it move in until the brown knuckles rested against the taut hide, and the short brown man, whose eyes had never left the entry place of the sword, now swung his sucked-in belly clear of the horn, and rocked clear from the animal, to stand holding the cloth on the stick in his left hand, raising his right hand, to watch the bull die. She saw him standing, his eyes watching the bull trying to hold the ground, watching the bull sway like a tree before it falls, watching the bull fight to hold his feet to the earth, the short man's hand raised in a formal gesture of triumph. She saw him standing there in the sweated, hollow relief of it being over, feeling the relief that the bull was dying, feeling the relief that there had been no shock, no blow of the horn as he came clear from it, and then as he stood, the bull could hold to the earth no longer and crashed over, rolling dead with all 4 feet in the air, and she could see the short brown man walking tired and unsmiling to the fence. She knew he could not run across the ring if his life depended on it, and she watched him walk slowly to the fence and wipe his mouth on a towel, and look up at her and shake his head, and then wipe his face on the towel and start his triumphant circling of the ring. She saw him moving slowly, dragging around the ring, smiling, bowing, smiling, his assistants walking behind him, stooping, picking up cigars, tossing back hats. He circling the ring, sad-eyed and smiling, to end the circle before her. Then she looked over and saw him sitting now on the step of the wooden fence, his mouth in a towel. Pilar saw all this as she stood there over the fire, and she said, "So he wasn't a good matador. With what class of people is my life past now?"
"He was a good matador," Pablo said. "He was handicapped by his short stature."
"And clearly it was tubercular," Primitivo said.
"Tubercular," Pilar said. "Who wouldn't be tubercular from the punishment he received? In this country where no poor man can ever hope to make money unless he is a criminal like Juan March, or a bullfighter, or a tenor in the opera, why wouldn't he be tubercular? In a country where the bourgeoisie overeat so that their stomachs are all ruined and they cannot live without bicarbonate of soda, and the poor are hungry from their birth till the day they die, why wouldn't he be tubercular? If you traveled under the seats in third-class carriages to ride free when you were following the fairs learning to fight as a boy, down there in the dust and dirt with the fresh spit and the dry spit, wouldn't you be tubercular if your chest was beaten out by horns?"
"Clearly," Primitivo said. "I only said he was tubercular."
"Of course he was tubercular," Pilar said, standing there with the big wooden stirring spoon in her hand. "He was short of stature, and he had a thin voice, and much fear of bulls. Never have I seen a man with more fear before the bullfight, and never have I seen a man with less fear in the ring. You," she said to Pablo, "you are afraid to die now. You think that is something of importance? But Finito was afraid all the time, and in the ring he was like a lion."
"He had the fame of being very valiant," the second brother said.
"Never have I known a man with so much fear," Pilar said. "He would not even have a bull's head in the house. One time at the feria of Valladolid, he killed a bull of Pablo Romero very well."
"I remember," the first brother said. "I was at the ring. It was a soap-colored one with a curly forehead and with very high horns. It was a bull of over 30 arrobas. It was the last bull he killed in Valladolid."
"Exactly," Pilar said. And afterwards the club of enthusiasts who met in the Café Colón, and had taken his name for their club, had the head of the bull mounted and presented it to him at a small banquet at the Café Colón. During the meal they had the head on the wall, but it was covered with a cloth. I was at the table and others were there, Pastora, who was uglier than I am, and the Niña de los Penes, and other gypsies and whores of great category. It was a banquet, small but of great intensity, and almost of a violence due to a dispute between Pastora and one of the most significant whores over a question of propriety. I myself was feeling more than happy, and I was sitting by Finito, and I noticed he would not look up at the bull's head, which was shrouded in a purple cloth, as the images of the saints are covered in church during the week of the Passion of our former Lord. Finito did not eat much, because he had received a palotazo, a blow from the flat of the horn when he had gone in to kill in his last corrida of the year at Zaragoza, and it had rendered him unconscious for some time, and even now he could not hold food on his stomach, and he would put his handkerchief to his mouth and deposit a quantity of blood in it at intervals throughout the banquet.
What was I going to tell you?
The bull's head, Primitivo said. The stuffed head of the bull.
Yes, Pilar said. Yes, but I must tell certain details so that you will see it. Finito was never very merry, you know. He was essentially solemn, and I had never known him when we were alone to laugh at anything, not even at things which were very comic. He took everything with great seriousness. He was almost as serious as Fernando. But this was a banquet given him by a club of aficionados, banded together into the Club Finito, and it was necessary for him to give an appearance of gaiety and friendliness and merriment. So all during the meal he smiled and made friendly remarks, and it was only I who noticed what he was doing with the handkerchief. He had 3 handkerchiefs with him, and he filled the 3 of them, and then he said to me in a very low voice, "Pilar, I can support this no further. I think I must leave." "Let us leave then," I said, for I saw he was suffering much. There was great hilarity by this time at the banquet, and the noise was tremendous. "No, I cannot leave," Finito said to me. "After all, it is a club named for me, and I have an obligation." "If thou art ill, let us go," I said. "Nay," he said, "I will stay.
Give me some of that manzanilla. I did not think it was wise of him to drink, since he had eaten nothing, and since he had a condition of the stomach, but he was evidently unable to support the merriment and the hilarity and the noise longer without taking something. So I watched him drink, very rapidly, almost a bottle of the manzanilla. Having exhausted his handkerchiefs, he was now employing his napkin for the use he had previously made of his handkerchiefs. Now indeed the banquet had reached a stage of great enthusiasm, and some of the least heavy of the whores were being paraded around the table on the shoulders of various of the club members. Pastora was prevailed upon to sing, and El Niño Ricardo played the guitar, and it was very moving, and an occasion of true joy and drunken friendship of the highest order. Never have I seen a banquet at which a higher pitch of real flamenco enthusiasm was reached, and yet we had not arrived at the unveiling of the bull's head, which was, after all, the reason for the celebration of the banquet. I was enjoying myself to such an extent, and I was so busy clapping my hands to the playing of Ricardo, and aiding to make up a team to clap for the singing of the Niña de los Penes, that I did not notice that Finito had filled his own napkin by now, and that he had taken mine. He was drinking more manzanilla now, and his eyes were very bright, and he was nodding very happily to everyone. He could not speak much, because at any time while speaking, he might have to resort to his napkin, but he was giving an appearance of great gaiety and enjoyment, which after all was what he was there for. So the banquet proceeded, and the man who sat next to me had been the former manager of Rafael El Gallo, and he was telling me a story, and the end of it was, so Rafael came to me and said, "You are the best friend I have in the world and the noblest. I love you like a brother, and I wish to make you a present." So then he gave me a beautiful diamond stick pin and kissed me on both cheeks, and we were both very moved. Then Rafael El Gallo, having given me the diamond stick pin, walked out of the cafe, and I said to Retana, who was sitting at the table, "That dirty gypsy has just signed a contract with another manager." "What do you mean?" Retana asked. "I've managed him for 10 years, and he has never given me a present before," the manager of El Gallo had said. "That's the only thing it can mean." And sure enough it was true, and that was how El Gallo left him. But at this point Pastora intervened in the conversation, not perhaps as much to defend the good name of Rafael, since no one had ever spoken harder against him than she had herself, but because the manager had spoken against the gypsies by employing the phrase, "dirty gypsy." She intervened so forcibly and in such terms that the manager was reduced to silence. I intervened to quiet Pastora, and another gitana intervened to quiet me, and the din was such that no one could distinguish any words which passed except the one great word, "whore," which roared out above all other words, until quiet was restored, and the three of us who had intervened sat looking down into our glasses, and then I noticed that Finito was staring at the bull's head, still draped in the purple cloth, with a look of horror on his face. At this moment the president of the club commenced the speech which was to precede the unveiling of the head, and all through the speech, which was applauded with shouts of "Olé!" and poundings on the table, I was watching Finito, who was making use of my napkin, and sinking further back in his chair, and staring with horror and fascination at the shrouded bull's head on the wall opposite him. Toward the end of the speech, Finito began to shake his head, and he got further back in the chair all the time. "How are you, little one?" I said to him, but when he looked at me he did not recognize me, and he only shook his head and said, "No, no, no." So the president of the club reached the end of the speech, and then with everybody cheering him, he stood on a chair and reached up and untied the cord that bound the purple shroud over the head and slowly pulled it clear of the head, and it stuck on one of the horns, and he lifted it clear and pulled it off the sharp, polished horns, and there was that great yellow bull with black horns that swung way out and pointed forward, their white tips sharp as porcupine quills, and the head of the bull was as though he were alive. His forehead was curly as in life, and his nostrils were open, and his eyes were bright, and he was there looking straight at Finito. Everyone shouted and applauded, and Finito sunk further back in the chair, and then everyone was quiet and looking at him, and he said, "No, no," and looked at the bull and pulled further back, and then he said, "No," very loudly, and a big blob of blood came out, and he didn't even put up the napkin, and it slid down his chin, and he was still looking at the bull, and he said, "All season, yes. To make money, yes. To eat, yes. But I can't eat. Hear me? My stomach's bad. But now with the season finished, no, no, no." He looked around at the table, and then he looked at the bull's head and said, "No," once more. And then he put his head down, and he put his napkin up to his mouth. And then he just sat there like that and said nothing. and the banquet which had started so well and promised to mark an epoch in hilarity and good fellowship was not a success.
Then how long after that did he die? Primitivo asked.
That winter, Pilar said. He never recovered from that last blow with the flat of the horn in Zaragoza. They are worse than a goring, for the injury is internal, and it does not heal. He received one almost every time he went in to kill, and it was for this reason he was not more successful. It was difficult for him to get out from over the horn because of his short stature. Nearly always the side of the horn struck him, but of course many were only glancing blows.
If he was so short, he should not have tried to be a matador, Primitivo said.
Pilar looked at Robert Jordan and shook her head. Then she bent over the big iron pot, still shaking her head.
What a people they are, she thought. What a people are the Spaniards. And if he was so short, he should not have tried to be a matador.
And I hear it and say nothing. I have no rage for that, and having made an explanation, I am silent. How simple it is when one knows nothing. Que sencillo.
Knowing nothing, one says, he was not much of a matador. Knowing nothing, another says, he was tubercular. And another says, after one, knowing, has explained, if he was so short, he should not have tried to be a matador.
Now, bending over the fire, she saw on the bed again the naked brown body with the gnarled scars in both thighs, the deep, seared whorl below the ribs on the right side of the chest, and the long white welt along the side that ended in the armpit. She saw the eyes closed and the solemn brown face and the curly black hair pushed back now from the forehead, and she was sitting by him on the bed, rubbing the legs, chafing the taut muscles of the calves, kneading them, loosening them, and then tapping them lightly with her folded hands, loosening the cramped muscles.
How is it? She said to him. How are the legs, little one?
Very well, Pilar, he would say, without opening his eyes.
Do you want me to rub the chest?
Nay, Pilar. Please do not touch it.
And the upper legs?
No, they hurt too badly.
But if I rub them and put liniment on, it will warm them and they will be better.
Nay, Pilar, thank thee. I would rather they were not touched.
I will wash thee with alcohol.
Yes, do it very lightly.
You were enormous in the last bull, she would say to him. And he would say, yes, I killed him very well.
Then, having washed him and covered him with a sheet, she would lie by him in the bed, and he would put a brown hand out and touch her and say, thou art much woman, Pilar. It was the nearest to a joke he ever made, and then usually after the fight he would go to sleep and she would lie there, holding his hand in her two hands and listening to him breathe. He was often frightened in his sleep, and she would feel his hand grip tightly and see the sweat bead on his forehead, and if he woke, she said, it's nothing, and he slept again. She was with him thus 5 years, and never was unfaithful to him, that is, almost never, and then after the funeral, she took up with Pablo, who led picador horses in the ring, and was like all the bulls that Finito had spent his life killing. But neither bull force nor bull courage lasted, she knew now. And what did last?
I last, she thought.
Yes, I have lasted. But for what?
Maria, she said, pay some attention to what you are doing. That is a fire to cook with, not to burn down a city.
Just then the gypsy came in the door. He was covered with snow, and he stood there holding his carbine and stamping the snow from his feet. Robert Jordan stood up and went over to the door.
Well, he said to the gypsy.
6 hour watches, 2 men at a time on the big bridge, the gypsy said. There are 8 men and a corporal at the roadmender's hut. Here is thy chronometer.
What about the sawmill post?
The old man is there. He can watch that and the road both.
And the road? Robert Jordan asked.
The same movement as always, the gypsy said. Nothing out of the usual. Several motor cars.
The gypsy looked cold. His dark face was drawn with the cold and his hands were red. Standing in the mouth of the cave, he took off his jacket and shook it.
I stayed until they changed the watch, he said. It was changed at noon and at 6. That is a long watch. I am glad I am not in their army.
Let us go for the old man, Robert Jordan said, putting on his leather coat.
Not me, the gypsy said. I go now for the fire and the hot soup. I will tell one of these where he is, and he can guide you. Hey, loafers, he called to the man who sat at the table. Who wants to guide the Inglés to where the old man is watching the road?
I will go, Fernando rose.
Tell me where it is. Listen, the gypsy said. It is here.
and he told him where the old man Anselmo was posted. Chapter 15. Anselmo was crouched in the lee of the trunk of a big tree, and the snow blew past on either side. He was pressed close against the tree, and his hands were inside of the sleeves of his jacket, each hand shoved up into the opposite sleeve, and his head was pulled as far down into the jacket as it would go. "If I stay here much longer, I will freeze," he thought, "and that will be of no value. The Inglés told me to stay until I was relieved, but he did not know then about this storm. There has been no abnormal movement on the road, and I know the dispositions and the habits of this post at the sawmill across the road. I should go now to the camp. Anybody with sense would be expecting me to return to the camp. I will stay a little longer," he thought, "and then go to the camp. It is the fault of the orders, which are too rigid. There is no allowance for a change in circumstance." He rubbed his feet together and then took his hands out of the jacket sleeves and bent over and rubbed his legs with them and patted his feet together to keep the circulation going. It was less cold there, out of the wind and the shelter of the tree, but he would have to start walking shortly. As he crouched, rubbing his feet, he heard a motor car on the road. It had on chains, and one link of chain was slapping, and as he watched, it came up the snow-covered road, green and brown painted, in broken patches of daubed color, the windows blued over so that you could not see in, with only a half-circle left clear in the blue for the occupants to look out through. It was a 2-year-old Rolls-Royce town car camouflaged for the use of the general staff, but Anselmo did not know that. He could not see into the car where 3 officers sat wrapped in their capes. 2 were on the back seat, and 1 sat on the folding chair. The officer on the folding chair was looking out of the slit in the blue of the window as the car passed, but Anselmo did not know this. Neither of them saw the other. The car passed in the snow directly below him. Anselmo saw the chauffeur, red-faced and steel-helmeted, his face and helmet projecting out of the blanket cape he wore, and he saw the forward jut of the automatic rifle the orderly who sat beside the chauffeur carried. Then the car was gone up the road, and Anselmo reached into the inside of his jacket and took out from his shirt pocket the 2 sheets torn from Robert Jordan's notebook and made a mark after the drawing of a motor car. It was the 10th car up for the day. 6 had come down. 4 were still up. It was not an unusual amount of cars to move upon that road, but Anselmo did not distinguish between the Fords, Fiats, Opels, Renaults, and Citroëns of the staff of the division that held the passes and the line of the mountain, and the Rolls-Royces, Lancias, Mercedes, and Isotas of the general staff. This was the sort of distinction that Robert Jordan should have made, and if he had been there instead of the old man, he would have appreciated the significance of these cars which had gone up. But he was not there, and the old man simply made a mark for a motor car going up the road on the sheet of notepaper. Anselmo was now so cold that he decided he had best go to camp before it was dark. He had no fear of missing the way, but he thought it was useless to stay longer, and the wind was blowing colder all the time, and there was no lessening of the snow. But when he stood up and stamped his feet and looked through the driving snow at the road, he did not start off up the hillside, but stayed leaning against the sheltered side of the pine tree. "The Inglés told me to stay," he thought. "Even now he may be on his way here, and if I leave this place he may lose himself in the snow searching for me. All through this war we have suffered from a lack of discipline and from the disobeying of orders, and I will wait a while still for the Inglés. But if he does not come soon I must go in spite of all orders, for I have a report to make now, and I have much to do in these days, and to freeze here is an exaggeration and without utility." Across the road at the sawmill smoke was coming out of the chimney, and Anselmo could smell it blown toward him through the snow. "The fascists are warm," he thought, "and they are comfortable, and tomorrow night we will kill them. It is a strange thing, and I do not like to think of it. I have watched them all day, and they are the same men that we are. I believe that I could walk up to the mill and knock on the door, and I would be welcome, except that they have orders to challenge all travelers and ask to see their papers. It is only orders that come between us. Those men are not fascists. I call them so, but they are not. They are poor men as we are. They should never be fighting against us, and I do not like to think of the killing. These at this post are Gallegos. I know that from hearing them talk this afternoon. They cannot desert, because if they do, their families will be shot. Gallegos are either very intelligent or very dumb and brutal. I have known both kinds. Lister is a Gallego from the same town as Franco. I wonder what these Gallegos think of this snow now at this time of year. They have no high mountains such as these, and in their country it always rains, and it is always green. A light showed in the window of the sawmill, and Anselmo shivered and thought, "Damn that Inglés! There are the Gallegos warm, and in a house, here in our country, and I am freezing behind a tree, and we live in a hole in the rocks like beasts in the mountain." But tomorrow, he thought, the beasts will come out of their hole, and these that are now so comfortable will die warm in their blankets, as those died in the night when we raided Otero, he thought. He did not like to remember Otero. In Otero that night was when he first killed, and he hoped he would not have to kill in this of the suppressing of these posts. It was in Otero that Pablo knifed the sentry when Anselmo pulled the blanket over his head, and the sentry caught Anselmo's foot and held it, smothered as he was in the blanket, and made a crying noise in the blanket, and Anselmo had to feel in the blanket and knife him until he let go of the foot and was still. He had his knee across the man's throat to keep him silent, and he was knifing into the bundle when Pablo tossed the bomb through the window into the room where the men of the post were all sleeping. And when the flash came, it was as though the whole world burst red and yellow before your eyes, and two more bombs were in already. Pablo had pulled the pins and tossed them quickly through the window, and those who were not killed in their beds were killed as they rose from bed when the second bomb exploded. That was in the great days of Pablo, when he scourged the country like a Tartar, and no fascist post was safe at night. And now he is as finished and as ended as a boar that has been altered, Anselmo thought. And when the altering has been accomplished, and the squealing is over, you cast the two stones away, and the boar, that is a boar no longer, goes snouting and rooting up to them, and eats them. No, he is not that bad, Anselmo grinned. One can think too badly, even of Pablo. But he is ugly enough, and changed enough. It is too cold, he thought, that the Inglés should come, and that I should not have to kill in this of the posts. These four Gallegos and their corporal are for those who like the killing. The Inglés said that. I will do it if it is my duty, but the Inglés said that I would be with him at the bridge, and that this would be left to others. At the bridge there will be a battle, and if I am able to endure the battle, then I will have done all that an old man may do in this war. But let the Inglés come now, for I am cold, and to see the light in the mill where I know that the Gallegos are warm makes me colder still. I wish that I were in my own house again, and that this war were over. But you have no house now, he thought. We must win this war before you can ever return to your house. Inside the sawmill, one of the soldiers was sitting on his bunk and greasing his boots. Another lay in his bunk, sleeping. The third was cooking, and the corporal was reading a paper. Their helmets hung on nails driven into the wall, and their rifles leaned against the plank wall. What kind of country is this where it snows when it is almost June? The soldier who was sitting on the bunk said.
It is a phenomenon, the corporal said.
We are in the moon of May, the soldier who was cooking said. The moon of May has not yet terminated.
What kind of country is it where it snows in May? The soldier on the bunk insisted.
In May, snow is no rarity in these mountains, the corporal said. I have been colder in Madrid in the month of May than in any other month.
And hotter, too, the soldier who was cooking said.
May is a month of great contrasts in temperature, the corporal said. Here in Castile, May is a month of great heat, but it can have much cold.
Or rain, the soldier on the bunk said. In this past May it rained almost every day. It did not, the soldier who was cooking said. And anyway, this past May was the moon of April.
One could go crazy listening to thee and thy moons, the corporal said. Leave this of the moons alone.
Anyone who lives either by the sea or by the land knows that it is the moon and not the month which counts, the soldier who was cooking said. Now, for example, we have just started the moon of May, yet it is coming on June.
Why then do we not get definitely behind in the seasons? The corporal said. The whole proposition gives me a headache.
You are from a town, the soldier who was cooking said. You are from Lugo. Why would you know of the sea or of the land?
One learns more in a town than you analfabetos learn in thy sea or thy land.
In this moon the first of the big schools of sardines come, the soldier who was cooking said. In this moon, the sardine boats will be outfitting, and the mackerel will have gone north.
Why are you not in the navy if you come from Noia? The corporal asked.
Because I am not inscribed from Noia, but from Negreira, where I was born. And from Negreira, which is up the river Tambre,
They take you for the army.
Worse luck, said the corporal.
Do not think the Navy is without peril, the soldier who was sitting on the bunk said. Even without the possibility of combat, that is a dangerous coast in the winter.
Nothing can be worse than the army, the corporal said.
And you a corporal, the soldier who was cooking said. What a way of speaking is that?
Nay, the corporal said, I mean for dangers. I mean the endurance of bombardments, the necessity to attack, the life of the parapet.
Here we have little of that, the soldier on the bunk said.
By the grace of God, the corporal said. But who knows when we will be subject to it again. Certainly we will not have something as easy as this forever.
How much longer do you think we will have this detail?
I don't know, the corporal said, but I wish we could have it for all of the war.
6 hours is too long to be on guard, the soldier who was cooking said.
We will have 3-hour watches as long as this storm holds, the corporal said. That is only normal.
What about all those staff cars? The soldier on the bunk asked. I did not like the look of all those staff cars.
Nor I, the corporal said. All such things are of evil omen.
And aviation, the soldier who was cooking said. Aviation is another bad sign.
But we have formidable aviation, the corporal said. The Reds have no aviation such as we have. Those planes this morning were something to make any man happy.
I have seen the Red planes when they were something serious, the soldier on the bunk said. I have seen those 2 motor bombers when they were a horror to endure.
Yes, but they are not as formidable as our aviation, the corporal said. We have an aviation that is insuperable.
This was how they were talking in the sawmill, while Anselmo waited in the snow watching the road and the light in the sawmill window.
I hope I am not for the killing, Anselmo was thinking. I think that after the war there will have to be some great penance done for the killing. If we no longer have religion after the war, then I think there must be some form of civic penance organized, that all may be cleansed from the killing, or else we will never have a true and human basis for living. The killing is necessary, I know, but still the doing of it is very bad for a man, and I think that after all this is over and we have won the war, there must be a penance of some kind for the cleansing of us all. Anselmo was a very good man, and whenever he was alone for long, and he was alone much of the time, this problem of the killing returned to him. I wonder about the Inglés, he thought. He told me that he did not mind it, yet he seems to be both sensitive and kind. It may be that in the younger people it does not have an importance. It may be that in foreigners, or in those who have not had our religion, there is not the same attitude. But I think anyone doing it will be brutalized in time, and I think that even though necessary, it is a great sin, and that afterwards we must do something very strong to atone for it.
It was dark now, and he looked at the light across the road and shook his arms against his chest to warm them. Now, he thought, he would certainly leave for the camp. But something kept him there beside the tree above the road. It was snowing harder, and Anselmo thought, if only we could blow the bridge tonight. On a night like this it would be nothing to take the posts and blow the bridge, and it would all be over and done with. On a night like this you could do anything. Then he stood there against the tree, stamping his feet softly, and he did not think any more about the bridge. The coming of the dark always made him feel lonely, and tonight he felt so lonely that there was a hollowness in him, as of hunger. In the old days he could help this loneliness by the saying of prayers, and often coming home from hunting he would repeat a great number of the same prayer, and it made him feel better. But he had not prayed once since the movement. He missed the prayers, but he thought it would be unfair and hypocritical to say them, and he did not wish to ask any favors or for any different treatment than all the men were receiving. No, he thought, I am lonely. But so are all the soldiers and the wives of all the soldiers, and all those who have lost families or parents. I have no wife, but I am glad that she died before the movement. She would not have understood it. I have no children, and I never will have any children. I am lonely in the day when I am not working, but when the dark comes, it is a time of great loneliness. But one thing I have that no man nor any god can take from me, and that is that I have worked well for the Republic. I have worked hard for the good that we will all share later. I have worked my best from the first of the movement, and I have done nothing that I am ashamed of. All that I am sorry for is the killing. But surely there will be an opportunity to atone for that, because for a sin of that sort that so many bear, certainly some just relief will be devised. I would like to talk with the Inglés about it.
but being young, it is possible that he might not understand. He mentioned the killing before. Or was it I that mentioned it? He must have killed much, but he shows no signs of liking it. In those who like it, there is always a rottenness. It must really be a great sin, he thought, because certainly it is the one thing we have no right to do, even though, as I know, it is necessary. But in Spain it is done too lightly, and often without true necessity, and there is much quick injustice which afterward can never be repaired. I wish I did not think about it so much, he thought. I wish there was a penance for it that one could commence now, because it is the only thing that I have done in all my life that makes me feel badly when I am alone. All the other things are forgiven, or one had a chance to atone for them by kindness or in some decent way. But I think this of the killing must be a very great sin, and I would like to fix it up. Later on there may be certain days that one can work for the state, or something that one can do that will remove it. It will probably be something that one pays, as in the days of the church, he thought, and smiled. The church was well organized for sin. That pleased him, and he was smiling in the dark when Robert Jordan came up to him. He came silently, and the old man did not see him until he was there. "Hola, viejo," Robert Jordan whispered, and clapped him on the back. "How's the old one?"
"Very cold," Anselmo said.
Fernando was standing a little apart, his back turned against the driving snow.
"Come on," Robert Jordan whispered. "Get on up to camp and get warm. It was a crime to leave you here so long."
"That is their light," Anselmo pointed.
"Where's the sentry?"
"You do not see him from here. He is around the bend."
"The hell with them," Robert Jordan said. "You tell me at camp. Come on, let's go."
"Let me show you," Anselmo said.
"I'm going to look at it in the morning," Robert Jordan said. "Here, take a swallow of this." He handed the old man his flask. Anselmo tipped it up and swallowed.
"Aye," he said, and rubbed his mouth. "It is fire."
"Come on," Robert Jordan said in the dark. "Let us go." It was so dark now you could only see the flakes blowing past, and the rigid dark of the pine trunks. Fernando was standing a little way up the hill. "Look at that cigar store Indian," Robert Jordan thought. "I suppose I have to offer him a drink."
"Hey, Fernando," he said as he came up to him. "A swallow?"
"No," said Fernando. "Thank you."
"Thank you, I mean," Robert Jordan thought. "I'm glad cigar store Indians don't drink. There isn't too much of that left."
"Boy, I'm glad to see this old man," Robert Jordan thought. He looked at Anselmo and then clapped him on the back again as they started up the hill.
"I'm glad to see you, viejo," he said to Anselmo. "If I ever get gloomy when I see you, it cheers me up. Come on, let's get up there."
They were going up the hill in the snow.
"Back to the palace of Pablo," Robert Jordan said to Anselmo. It sounded wonderful in Spanish.
"El Palacio del Miedo," Anselmo said. "The Palace of Fear."
"La Cueva de los Huevos Perdidos," Robert Jordan capped the other happily. "The Cave of the Lost Eggs."
"What eggs?" Fernando asked.
"A joke," Robert Jordan said. "Just a joke. Not eggs, you know. The others."
"But why are they lost?" Fernando asked.
"I don't know," said Robert Jordan. "Take a book to tell you. Ask Pilar."
Then he put his arm around Anselmo's shoulder and held him tight as they walked and shook him.
"Listen," he said, "I'm glad to see you here.
You don't know what it means to find somebody in this country in the same place they were left." It showed what confidence and intimacy he had that he could say anything against the country.
"I am glad to see thee," Anselmo said, "but I was just about to leave."
"Like hell you would have," Robert Jordan said happily. "You'd have frozen first."
"How was it up above?" Anselmo said.
"Fine," said Robert Jordan. "Everything is fine." He was very happy, with that sudden, rare happiness that can come to anyone with a command in a revolutionary arm. The happiness of finding that even one of your flanks holds. If both flanks ever held, I suppose it would be too much to take, he thought. I don't know who is prepared to stand that. And if you extend along a flank, any flank, it eventually becomes one man. Yes, one man. This was not the axiom he wanted, but this was a good man. One good man. "You are going to be the left flank when we have the battle," he thought. "I better not tell you that yet." It's going to be an awfully small battle, he thought, but it's going to be an awfully good one. Well, I always wanted to fight one on my own.
I always had an opinion on what was wrong with everybody else's, from Agincourt down. I will have to make this a good one. It is going to be small, but very select. If I have to do what I think I will have to do, it will be very select indeed. Listen, he said to Anselmo, I'm awfully glad to see you. And me to see thee, the old man said. As they went up the hill in the dark, the wind at their backs, the storm blowing past them as they climbed, Anselmo did not feel lonely. He had not been lonely since the Inglés had clapped him on the shoulder. The Inglés was pleased and happy, and they joked together. The Inglés said it all went well, and he was not worried. The drink in his stomach warmed him, and his feet were warming now climbing. Not much on the road, he said to the Inglés. Good, the Inglés told him. You will show me when we get there. Anselmo was happy now, and he was very pleased that he had stayed there at the post of observation. If he had come into camp, it would have been all right. It would have been the intelligent and correct thing to have done under the circumstances, Robert Jordan was thinking. But he stayed as he was told, Robert Jordan thought. That's the rarest thing that can happen in Spain. To stay in a storm, in a way, corresponds to a lot of things. It's not for nothing that the Germans call an attack a storm. I could certainly use a couple more who would stay. I most certainly could. I wonder if that Fernando would stay. It's just possible. After all, he is the one who suggested coming out just now. Do you suppose he would stay? Wouldn't that be good? He's just about stubborn enough. I'll have to make some inquiries. Wonder what the old cigar store Indian is thinking about now. What are you thinking about, Fernando? Robert Jordan asked. Why do you ask? Curiosity, Robert Jordan said. I am a man of great curiosity. I was thinking of supper, Fernando said. Do you like to eat? Yes, very much. How's Pilar's cooking? Average, Fernando answered. He's a second Coolidge, Robert Jordan thought. But you know I have just a hunch that he would stay. The three of them plodded up the hill in the snow. Chapter 16 El Sordo is here, Pilar said to Robert Jordan. They had come in out of the storm to the smoky warmth of the cave, and the woman had motioned Robert Jordan over to her with a nod of her head.
He's gone to look for horses.
Good. Did he leave any word for me?
Only that he had gone for horses.
And we?
No sé, she said. Look at him.
Robert Jordan had seen Pablo when he came in, and Pablo had grinned at him. Now he looked over at him sitting at the board table, and grinned and waved his hand.
Inglés, Pablo called. It's still falling, Inglés.
Robert Jordan nodded at him.
Let me take thy shoes and dry them, Maria said. I will hang them here in the smoke of the fire.
Watch out you don't burn them, Robert Jordan told her. I don't want to go around here barefoot.
What's the matter? He turned to Pilar. Is this a meeting? Haven't you any sentries out? In this storm? Que va?
There were six men sitting at the table and leaning back against the wall. Anselmo and Fernando were still shaking the snow from their jackets, beating their trousers and wrapping their feet against the wall by the entrance.
Let me take thy jacket, Maria said. Do not let the snow melt on it.
Robert Jordan slipped out of his jacket, beat the snow from his trousers, and untied his shoes.
You will get everything wet here, Pilar said.
It was thee who called me.
Still, there is no impediment to returning to the door for thy brushing.
Excuse me, Robert Jordan said, standing in his bare feet on the dirt floor.
Hunt me a pair of socks, Maria.
The Lord and Master, Pilar said, and poked a piece of wood into the fire.
Hay que aprovechar el tiempo, Robert Jordan told her.
You have to take advantage of what time there is.
It is locked, Maria said.
Here's the key, and he tossed it over.
It does not fit this sack.
It is the other sack. They are on top and at the side. The girl found the pair of socks, closed the sack, locked it, and brought them over with the key.
Sit down and put them on, and rub thy feet well, she said.
Robert Jordan grinned at her.
Thou canst not dry them with thy hair, he said for Pilar to hear.
What a swine, she said. First he is the lord of the manor, now he is our ex-lord himself. Hit him with a chunk of wood, Maria.
Nay, Robert Jordan said to her, I am joking because I am happy.
You are happy?
Yes, he said. I think everything goes very well.
Roberto, Maria said, go sit down and dry thy feet and let me bring thee something to drink to warm thee.
You would think that man had never dampened foot before, Pilar said, nor that a flake of snow had ever fallen.